Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 232. And I'm joined this beak. I've got a beak. There's no beak. I'm joined this week by Josh Weller, who's fantastic. He's been a mate of mine for years. I've known him for ages. We talk about it all in the podcast. I won't go into it in great detail, but I heard him recently on the Hardcore Listing podcast and then on Off the Beaten Track podcast, and on both of them, he was just so entertaining and articulate, but also funny, irreverent, but also a good lad. And I thought, I've been meaning to have him on for ages. I need to pull my finger out. So I did exactly that. Before we get into it, there's a big announcement on this. He's hinted details of it on social media, but this is the big announcement. So that's exciting too. I'm sorry if I sound distracted, but I'm recording this on Friday, and I'm sat on my bed, and the TV's on in the background, and I left it on as I was getting my kit to record, and I wasn't really paying attention, and Bargain Hunt has started, and Bez from the Happy Mondays is against Jarvis Cocker from Pulp on Bargain Hunt. That's weird, isn't it? That's a weird sentence. I wonder if I'm on drugs. I don't think I'm on drugs. But yeah, that's weird. Anyway, that's why I was slightly distracted. I mean, speaking of musicians and that, Josh is a musician. We've recently had Payday. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. That's where you can go and support all the speech development artists and stuff. I mean, I talk on here. Josh, I recorded this with Josh the week after it had been announced that his band split up. And again, we kind of talk about how tough it is in the music industry these days. We do go in on Spotify. So yeah, but SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com is a good place to go and support. That makes me think as well, I had some angry people online this week. It was so funny, but people were proper angry. I'll explain it to you now because it's funny to me, but some of you will probably get angry. I did a tweet, right? I've been having some gardening work done, and the guys who were doing it have ghosted me a little bit. And that's fine. These things happen. But I thought, I was looking through to try and find someone else good, and I was struggling. And I thought, oh, I'll do a tweet. And I did a tweet saying, look, anyone in the southeast who does landscaping and astroturfing, if you want to hit me up and maybe do me a deal, you know, in exchange for some posts, some things like that on social media. And again, I didn't think about it. I then went off and got on with my day. And when I came back, there was fury online because people thought, number one, I was asking for it for free, which I wasn't. I was saying a deal. I'm open to discussion on that. I'm from Essex. We love a barter. We love exchanging goods for goods, services for services. And people were saying, yeah, well, you know, people think exposure's worth a lot more than it is. And I'm like, well, number one, I've not put a price on it. I've kind of said, look, have a chat, come and have a look, do me a deal. And number two, I pay my bills off of exposure, off of the sponsors on the Wonderful Distraction Pieces podcast and stuff like that. So it's one of them. I was like, I didn't see it as this horrible thing. The way I saw it, and I explained, and this gets funny as well, was, you know, I don't know if it happens around your way, but in my part of Essex, if someone does like your roof, or your the example I gave was if you've had your drive tarmacked or whatever, then they'll give you some money off or something to, if they can leave a sign there for a few weeks to advertise it to other people. And weirdly, I then, after I'd posted that example, I walked around my mum's to go and see her for a meal that we were going out for. And she had a sign for the roofer who's doing her roof at the moment. I didn't even know she was having her roof done. So it was pure chance. But yeah, I gave that as an example. But people got angry because people get mad at unpaid internships and stuff like that. And I get it. Yeah, I don't know. For me, all of those things are a case-by-case situation. I think it's terrible that people rip people off. But also, I've done tons of stuff for free over the years. Like, loads. I literally on, or even at a loss, you know, because it's a choice. The example I was thinking as well was on my Distraction Pieces tour. we headlined Coco, which is a big venue. But on the European run, I was running that at a loss, and I knew that because the fees, because I had a band who I felt deserved a fee, a set fee for every gig, not a varying fee, or I'll pay you when I can, a set fee for every show. And that meant that when we're in Europe, the fees are lower because it's smaller crowds. But, you know, I still had a tour manager I'm paying and a band I'm paying. So it's things like that. I've done stuff. I chose to do that at a loss there. I featured on a DJ Yoda. No, that's another example I thought of. Was Glastonbury. Glastonbury, because it's a better example. Because it's Glastonbury. I've never played for free, but Glastonbury, every year I've played it, which is 6 or 7 times, it's always been the lowest pay I get of the festival season. Because you kind of, they trade a little bit off. Well, you're playing Glastonbury, you know. Except for once, actually. The last time it was paid well, but every other time it was a low-paying one compared to other festivals. And it's a similar thing there. Was it in my thinking it was a similar thing there? Again, I ain't asking for someone to come and AstroTurf my garden for free. All I put up casually without even thinking was, you know, I'll do some tweets about it. I'll push your business. Again, gardening is another one, particularly on Instagram. Woodwork, gardening, anything that you can post good pictures of, it's something that the social media is a good tool if you're good at that kind of thing. All the big table in the Distraction Pieces studio, I got off someone I just saw on social media, a woodwork company. So those things help. But anyway, that was all a wonderful drama, and people were furious at me and think that I want slaves, essentially. I don't want slaves. I'm all right for slaves. I'm not even that into bargains. But no, that the reason that came to mind is I mentioned Spotify. Because I was thinking, I guarantee tons of these people who are getting angry at that have got Spotify, which essentially pays artists fuck all. Like a tiny amount. Particularly small artists who are just as setting off. If you Google the amount of songs unplayed on Spotify, but then equally, if you Google the songs that only have 100 plays, if a song has had 100 plays, they are going to get a penny, if that. And let's imagine, for example, there's a few prices on iTunes, but let's imagine it's 99p, because we'll call that a quid and it's easier to round up. That means if 100 people had bought that track, then that artist would have made 100 quid. Instead, they're making, I mean, let's really push the boat out and say they've made a quid. That means for the exposure, the benefit of the exposure on being on Spotify, they're getting 99% off of what they would have earned. It's crazy. But yeah, anyway, I just found it amusing because people got proper angry. And then I just ended by saying the deal still stands. If you AstroTurf my garden, I'll wank you off. But yeah, people get mad at this stuff. It is what depresses me about social media a little bit. It's why I love the Patreon. And this isn't an intentional plug, but patreon.com/scroobiouspip. Over there, if I posted about it, I would have had some people giving some intelligent, articulate argument. I don't mean to say anyone wasn't intelligent. They were fine, but they would have been calm and reasoned. And the problem with other social media is the hour or 2 hours away from it, I came back and it was a given now that I wanted someone to do tons of work for free. So that I literally never said that anywhere. I said, you can do me a deal. I mean, free is pretty, it's a bit more than a deal, right? It's free. But yeah, anyway, that was fun. But Patreon.com, speaking of which, help me pay for my AstroTurf. That's a joke, because all the money from Patreon goes into my business, which is how I pay for Distraction Pieces stuff, label stuff, all that kind of thing, all creative endeavours. So I've taken the same wage from that company for since I set it up probably 8 or 9 years ago now. I mean, I'll tell you, I take a $1,500 a month is my monthly wage. And I don't need a lot to live off, because I will, because I'm always working, I'll pay for petrol on the company. This is a lot of information I'm sharing here, but yeah, I take a low wage because I've got low living expenses. So the Patreon isn't me saying, oh, come and pay for my weekly pizzas or whatever. It's chipping in for podcast costs. You know, it will allow me in the future to travel to visit people for a specific podcast, to offer to put people up in a hotel for a podcast and things like that. So yeah, it's cool. But yeah, it's patreon.com/scribblespirit, and that's what I say. And what I like, this is the rambliest intro ever. And what I like over there is that it is this kind of just a really friendly community. And the fact is, everyone who can see the stuff there has paid to see the stuff there. So there aren't these people who are just getting pulled in by someone else commenting. Because again, my argument is, I understand how people could misinterpret that tweet, but my argument is, if you follow me for any length of time, you should kind of know I'm not a piece of shit. So unless it's really clear that I'm making a piece of shit statement, I think I get the benefit of the doubt here and there. You know, like if I then respond saying, oh no, I'm not after anything for free, that you go, all right, cool. Rather than, well, it certainly seems as if, what? And that's the beauty of over at the Patreon, is you don't get any of those people who haven't followed or whatever else, who just jump in because we love getting outraged. But yeah, patreon.com/scroobiuspip if you want to get involved in any of that goodness. And the Patreon lot knew that this podcast was coming, because every time I go and record a podcast, I post the selfie I do on the Patreon. So over there, they get a heads up. And also on merch stuff. We recently had some vinyl come out and some of the shoes come out. And they sold out within a short amount of time, let's say. But the Patreon lot got a heads up on that. So it's only 80p a month, mate, or a quid, or whatever it works out at. As someone pulled me up saying, you're telling everyone it's 80p a month, and they add tax on checkout or that or whatever else. And I'm like, all right, mate, well, it might be a quid a month then. All right, it might be 120 a month. I mean, you can pledge. I had a beautiful thing at the end of this month where a lot of people upped their pledge, which is really nice, because that means that they're feeling it's good value, even though it's just a pledge thing. But yeah, anyway, ramble. Let's hear Josh. I love Josh. He's great. If you enjoy this, I recommend him on other podcasts, but I'll come back at the end to do some plug in there. This is episode 232 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Josh Weller. Always lovely.
There's a hum in the background of my life. It's yeah, absolutely fine.
I've started rolling, as is the traditional manner of podcasts. I'm with Josh Weller. How are you, sir?
Good, mate. How are you?
I'm good. And I've led you into the basement of a club. There's no windows. There's no natural light.
No.
You feeling comfortable?
I mean, if it was 4 a.m, I'd feel weird about it.
Yeah.
But it smells like bleach. The floor's not sticky.
Yeah.
Any sin that's going to happen tonight hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. We're at the Queen of Hoxton, who are wonderful, who are this sister venue of the book club where me and Stu do our club night. They also have the Hoxton Bar and Kitchen, where you've done two podcasts now with Stu. And I've loved both of them.
Thanks.
I tweeted after the Hardcore Listing one, I genuinely think you don't get better value for money on a podcast than Josh. Because you're passionate about what you're passionate about, and you're articulate, and I don't know, I like you as a podcast guest.
Oh, thanks very much.
Obviously, we normally don't say nice things about each other.
You can like chase it with an insult.
Yeah, or that's it. I'd prepared a nice thing to say, which I've now got, I can chase with a slight insult. I was discussing last night with someone who wasn't aware of your stuff, and I was just saying how you're someone that, for some reason, you draw belief in you. And let me explain that. When you were doing kind of more twee singer-songwriter stuff, I was like, this guy's amazing, he can do that. As soon as I heard you were doing a punk band, I was like, yep,
He can do that. As soon as I was hearing all the different projects that we're going to talk about, I'm not sure how many we can get into, but there's a few different ones. And at no point have I thought, oh, that seems a bit odd. Everything, like, there'll be stuff like, are you saying tonight you're doing some stand-up, right? Is that the case?
I am. Oh, I mean, yeah.
I've just dropped it in there out of nowhere.
I haven't. Yeah, no, I've been doing open mics. It doesn't mean that I'm now a stand-up.
Yeah. No, but that's just... And that was the thing. As soon as I heard that, I was like, yeah, I can see that. And it's a weird one. Jordan Gray, who's a previous guest who was on The Voice, in Team Paloma, who we're both known for years.
Is that how we met?
Yeah, I think it would have been through Paloma about 11 years ago.
Yeah.
A while back.
Yeah, I found a flyer recently from a gig that we did with her.
Yeah.
And the lineup's like, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's like you, me, Kate Nash, Adele.
Yeah.
Eliza Doolittle. Paloma.
I'm glad you're saying this, because every now and then I mention the days of gigging with all them and people are like, oh yeah, like as if I'm name dropping. But that was the kind of scene, wasn't it?
That's how it started, isn't it, really? Yeah. Everyone was a kid and everyone... The thing is, the way I put that stuff down to, you know, those moving to London and kind of when you talk about it now and it sounds like you're name dropping, really what it is... When you're 18 and you do 5 gigs a week, and there's 5 people on the bill every night,
exactly that,
and there's only 70 bands, 100 bands doing it.
Completely.
By process of elimination, some of them are going to become megastars.
Yeah, and they're the ones that you're naturally going to remember the names of,
because
you see them everywhere now. But yeah, so I was going there is when I heard that a Jordan Gray, Tall Dark Friend, was moving into stand up. I was like, I don't know if that's going to work. I've then seen her show. It's amazing. She did The Fringe this year, was one of the big
Edinburgh
successes,
right?
Of The Fringe, and did... She got asked to do Late and Live once, which is like the fire pit of testing yourself, and she ended up closing it almost every night after that, because she just smashed it. So she's... Again, but it's one of them where I heard that, I thought, oh, I don't know how that's going to work, whereas as soon as I heard you were moving in that area, I was like, yeah, I can see how that would work. But... The further illustration of the slickness and the just adaptability is you did the slickest move of offering to bring some drinks today to cover up the fact that you were late. And it's the smoothest move. I was standing out the front thinking, where's Josh? And then I get a text going, do you want a drink or anything? It's like, I can't get angry at you being late now.
Hang on a minute.
A few minutes.
It was like 6 minutes. Yeah. I was on time and I thought... My thought process was, I'm going to want a glass of water when I'm in there. The bar's going to be shut.
Yeah,
I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
Then they have to go behind the bar and then they, you know.
Yeah, no, I get you.
So I just thought, I'll be 6 minutes late.
It's a slick move.
But
it's
I'll cover that.
I like it. Bar offering to get a drink. I love it. But so let's kind of... there's so much I want to talk about, and there's so much I've heard recently on Hardcore Listening and off the Beaten Track, and I think they're both great podcasts. And
they are great podcasts. Stu is a great man.
You and Stu have got a bit of a romance going on. You've both been texting me about each other.
We've both been texting each other about you. I've really enjoyed those two. I've struggled with going on podcasts.
Yeah,
because I don't really feel like. I mean, even this one, it's like. You know, you had Spike Lee on here. That's quite a drop-off to then get me on. Like, that's quite a step down.
Not at all.
But it's... That one was really, like, made me feel like, oh, yeah, this is actually when it's good, when you go on a podcast and it's just talking and it's comfortable.
Yeah.
And Stu's very, very good at making people feel at ease. And,
yeah.
You know. And also, Hardcore Listening and Off the Beaten Track, the concepts of the two are both...
It's the structures of them. It's what I love as well about... Films to be buried with, a Brett's one. It's like the beauty of all of them is because I turn people down on this podcast all the time, and it's never an insult. It's just, do I think I'm the right person to get a 60 to 90 minute conversation out of them? And if I don't know their career well enough or don't feel enough of a connection, I don't feel I'm the right person. I've turned down some huge bands, some big rugby players, all sorts of other stuff, because I'm like, right, I'm not the right person for that. Whereas on any of those three podcasts, I would argue that they can literally have anyone because the format fills the time itself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? As long as the guest picks something that they're passionate about, you're off at
it's
off one the
of
races.
The, it's like a It's like desert island discs or a bacon sandwich. You know, I mean, some things.
Yeah.
There's a reason the Big Mac has been around for 50 years.
Completely.
You know?
Completely. I love it. But let's talk a little bit, because again, what we touched upon, or what I heard, I'm not just going to re-go over the stuff from them podcasts, but I'm also not going to exclude anything that seemed interesting there, because I'm not going to assume that everyone who listens to this listens to those shitty C-list podcasts as well as my A-list podcast.
This is, but you know, I would maybe say sometimes the biggest one isn't the best one.
Well, it's arguable. You know what I mean? The numbers say differently, but, you know, it's hard to say. But then both of our careers would argue otherwise if you look at the people that we've gigged with, we're way better than Adele and Kate and all of them, but, you know, we might not have...
We were a lot further down the ladder.
We are. Yeah. But so what was interesting was I didn't really know much about your upbringing and where you grew up and where you lived and stuff like that. So what was your kind of...
Well, I was...
Your movements?
It was Mauritian mum,
yeah.
English dad. So white dad, black mum.
Yeah.
Born in Lincolnshire. So I was born... Right. And my dad was in the Air Force. So we moved around a lot when I was a kid. So he was I think at that point was a medic in the Air Force. So he was in the Gulf War.
Yeah.
And he won some kind of medal, because they landed on an airfield that they'd been told to fly over,
right?
That had been damaged, and they landed and saved a bunch of people, and didn't follow orders.
I mean, the saved a bunch of people bit justified the medal then. Then, I was like, they landed somewhere they were told not to, and he got a medal.
Well, they went go-karting.
Yeah, exactly. They took a day off and went down the beach.
And and that he was in the Gulf War, and then we moved to Malaysia. So my dad went and worked for the Sultan of Brunei.
Wow.
Who had two wives. I think he still has two wives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Sultan of Brunei was, at that point, mid-90s, was the richest man in the world. I think he was just about to be eclipsed by Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And I met him once. We went to... There was a Muslim... I think it was maybe the end of Ramadan, where he invited all the Air Force people to his palace.
Yeah.
And... It was very... All the men get to meet all the men of the royal family.
Wow,
And all the women get to meet all the women.
Yeah.
And then we went into this room where he gave everyone money.
Fantastic.
It was like
a room to go in.
I was only five or six. I remember it very clearly. And the Sultan of Brunei, he didn't give it out, but his minions handed everyone a tray with some sweet treats and then $10 in the middle.
Right. Genuinely, the exciting thing back in the day of going to visit my dad's mum and dad in Streatham was they had a little jar that had sweets, and you could take a handful, as much as you could get in hand. And then later on, they had a jar that had, I think, 5p's in, and it was the same thing. You can take as much as you can get in one handful.
5p's?
Yeah, yeah.
Only 5p coins?
Only 5p coins, yeah.
Oh.
So it's this. So it's still going to be, it's not going to be a huge amount, but it's exciting. Because you're like, yes, I've got a load of
my. It was the same with my auntie in Romford. So my family's all from Romford, and my mum's family, and it was penguin bars.
Right, yeah.
So my auntie had this little cupboard that was full of chocolates.
Yeah.
And then when I was sort of 6 years old, realised, got wise to where the cupboard was, and there was, you know, Cadbury's roses are in a blue box.
Yep, yep.
And then one time I stole blue box of chocolate roses, but it was a box of J-cloths. So I snuck it in my bag.
Beautiful.
Got back home. It's karma.
Had to do some cleaning. I love that even when you become the richest man in the world, that process remains the same. It's just, we'll give him some sweets and some money.
The Sultan of Brunei's brother was cut off from the royal family because he was spending £500,000 a week.
Oh, damn.
And he had three yachts.
Yeah.
Right? The names of his yachts when they cut him off were Nipple One, Nipple Two, and Tits.
Brilliant.
And you can Google that.
What a dude. That's what an absolute
one odd.
Dude.
If you're going to spend your brother's oil money, just do it inconspicuously.
I love it. Nipple One, Nipple Two, and Tits. It's beautiful.
I like that he probably didn't have a name for the third one as well. It sounds like he ran dry on ideas, doesn't it? Nipple One, Nipple Two. Oh, shit. Tits.
Tits, I guess. Fanny seems too crude. Tits. So how was that life? Because that's something that you see in films you see the military kids, the military brats, the military, you know, the kids that who have their life in one town and then move somewhere else. How was that to grow up in?
I think it's why there's a lot of making new friends.
Yeah.
I think in my adulthood, it's why I hold my friends so closely, and I regard them as so important. It's because I never, because they were always changing when I was a kid.
Constantly evolving, I guess.
And I think, I mean, it was a Muslim country, so I learned a lot about, you know, whenever I hear stories in the news now, and it's like, a couple have gone to jail for 7 years for having sex on a beach in Dubai. Mm. I'm like, well, that's a silly law.
Yeah.
But equally, if that's their law.
That's their law. It's a fascinating one.
It's odd one.
It's so fascinating to have grown up in those situations and then come here, because it's easy for us to look down our nose or criticise, and rightfully so in places. There's many misogynistic laws and very, you know, negative things in that way. But there's also a lot of history in it, and a lot of history in their beliefs and these. And there's a lot of good stuff there. I heard a guy, Sam Harris, I heard him doing a thought experiment on Russell Brand's podcast, I think it was. And Sam Harris is quite, he loves American. He's to say he's anti-Muslim sounds attacking.
Is he like a public talker?
It's him and Jordan Peterson and a few others, academics who are kind of in this kind of area. And again, even with Jordan Peterson, there's some stuff of his I've heard him say that I think's quite good. I think there's a load that just seems dumb and people don't argue it in intelligent manners, and because he's calm, he comes across the better. But Sam Harris is similar in that way. And again, a lot of stuff is quite fair and quite right. Again, I've got friends who are in the army and are quite, in many ways, are quite anti-Muslim because they've seen their mates die at the hands of these things. So, you know, it's hard to argue that. I don't agree with it myself, but it's hard to argue that. So Sam Harris put forth this thought experiment to Russell Brand. He said, so you're saying that you support the integration of faiths and the leniency of Muslims in this country and things like that. You've got a daughter. How would you feel about her going on a school trip and she goes and spends a month living in a strict Muslim country under the Sharia law and all that kind of thing? And Russell kind of, he rustles it a bit. He goes off on a different tangent, as Russell loves to do. I love him dearly, but, and again, I got that as a thought experiment. I got, right, yeah, you wouldn't want that for your daughter, potentially, because of these restrictions. But my argument that I was annoyed that Russell didn't make and no one made was, it works the other way as well. If you've grown up in a strict Muslim company, and the thought experiment is, do you want your daughter to go to the West where women are sexualized constantly and encouraged and pushed to wear skimpier clothing and be sexy and post stuff on Instagram and this kind of thing? You'd have the same. So while it's just, it's different belief systems, it doesn't have to be you're right and you're wrong. It's like, well, there's a middle ground, right?
It's just, the school I was in had a fence down the middle.
And wow.
It was Muslims on one side and then all the others on the other.
Wow.
And that I remember, crazy, like, we used to climb over the fence at lunch break. I mean, we wouldn't go in their playground, but we'd like swap toys and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, I just judge every case on its merit. So, look, it does. Some people are nice, some people are idiots. Doesn't matter what. Yeah, and that crosses into every faith, you know.
Yeah, and again, it crosses into different areas of society, right? Because from what I would imagine at that time, because you moved, how old were you?
When we moved back to England, I was, I think, 8, 9. So I was young when we moved there, 4 or 5.
And that would have been late 80s, early 90s?
No, it was 90. So we moved back in 90. I think we moved back in 96.
In 96. Yeah. So even then, that would, I would imagine, possibly be the first time you experience some racism and stuff like that.
No, man, never.
No.
I didn't experience any. Oh, wait, do you mean in Malaysia, in Brunei?
No. When you moved back to the UK.
That's
kind of my thing. There is all these restrictions over here, but it's not as if we're playing from a perfect deck of cards over here. So you don't get that much racism over in Malaysia. You get, again, conflict in belief and conflict in different areas of belief. But But racism isn't nearly as prevalent a thing, right? And as you were just saying, you didn't really experience any over there.
But it was a, you know, it was a brown country, and I was a little brown kid, so it kind of made sense mathematically.
Yeah, yeah.
And then moving back, thing is, my, you know, my parents. It's really funny. Like, I was talking to someone about white privilege recently.
Yeah.
And I was having an argument with a friend of mine who doesn't, who is white, who doesn't believe white privilege exists, right?
It's crazy to me that you...
And, but to me, that's the perfect example of white privilege
as well.
But he was saying, and white privilege is, it is, it's a very base level term for something that's really complicated.
Yeah.
But we were talking about white privilege, and I was talking to my dad about it recently. We went on holiday, and we moved from Brunei to Suffolk.
Yeah, man, that's a hell of a... That's a hell of a trip.
Which is insane when I think about it now. And my parents never raised me to think about the color of my skin. My mum was black, my dad was white, and it was never, ever mentioned. They never went, and actually, I think it was a really positive thing. I don't know if they did it intentionally or what, but like it was, my mum never sat me down and went, hey, look, I'm black, your dad's white. Some people view those two things differently, and people are going to judge you weirdly when now we come back to it. It just wasn't mentioned. And there are pros and cons to having to fend for yourself in those situations when it comes out of the other people.
Of course, yeah.
And I was asking my dad about it, and I was like, did it ever cross your mind that, you know, when we moved from, you know, let's call it a brown country to a white country, did it ever cross your mind that I would have experienced certain prejudices based on just the color of my skin? And my dad was like, no, honestly, never. And he was completely sincere. He's like, I'd never thought about it.
Amazing.
And I was talking to a friend the other night, and we were both talking about he's trying to date this girl, and he was like, she's never going to date a brown guy. And I was like, of course she's not. Of course she's not. She's never going to... I mean, I know her. She's never going to date a brown guy.
Right.
And in both those circumstances, my friend, other friend who was there, who's white, was like, he went, that's so weird. I've never thought about it like that. It's never even crossed my mind that someone wouldn't date you because of the color of your skin. And then my dad as well was like, oh, it never crossed my mind that you might have experienced. And that is like, white privilege isn't necessarily walking past a bank and someone opening the door and offering you a £100,000 loan.
Exactly. And it's not even saying that you've had a categorically privileged life. But again, I think always think the simplest example is if the first time you've had or felt challenged in that way is when someone online or someone is talking about white privilege, then that does mean you've had somewhat of a blessed life. If the first time you've encountered it hasn't been someone shouting abuse at you in the street or someone crossing the road when they see you walk along. It was fascinating. I was hearing, I think it might have been Stu talking about it on Off the Beat and Track with you, where he was saying when he was growing up, there was the black kid at school, and he didn't mean to be racist, but it was that time. That's, oh, he's the black kid.
Yeah.
And I have to concede that in my youth, going to Brixton for gigs was scary because of the scary black guy drug. Like, again, there was drugs being dealt there. They happened to be black guys. But for me, as a young, ignorant, a white kid from Essex, there was an extra scariness attached to skin colour, which I've now grown out of, and it's ridiculous, but that was there. That was something that was prevalent in the country at that point. There was an attachment and a prejudice decided by colour of skin, and that's what white privilege is, because it's the opposite in that way.
Exactly.
It's the assumption that this kid's probably all right or not that bad. And it's like, well, my first three drug dealers were white. You know, it's like there's no...
When I was a kid, the guy who did the our local drug dealer when I was a teenager was his name was Ratface Perv.
Brilliant.
Right? He's a white guy in Norwich, right? And his name he was about 4'2", and his name was Ratface Perv because he was a little Ratface Perv.
Yeah,
right? And there was a house party, and some people had ordered some drugs.
Yeah.
And Ratface Perv shows up. He knocks on the door. It's not my house. I go to the door. I let him in. He comes into the living room, and I'm like, guys, Ratface Perv is here, right? And then he leaves the room, and then everyone just goes, dude, no one calls him that to his face.
Amazing. Amazing. You just a show different. Hey, Ratface Perv.
Oh, God. But yeah, no, I called the police recently. I live in Bethnal Green. and I live opposite this. I mean, you could call it a park. It's a level of land that used to be green. Right?
Yeah.
And I saw these kids running out of it recently. They're about 15, 16. It was only 6:30, 7 o'clock in the evening, and I was walking down Bethnal Green Road. And these kids run out of this park, and one of them like readjusts his tracksuit bottoms, and there's this huge 12-inch blade knife.
Damn.
I don't know if I talked about this on Stu's podcast. And I called the police and, you know, said, I'm not sure if this is an emergency. And the woman went, well, why don't you tell me what it is and I'll tell you if it's an emergency. And I went, well, there's a kid on Bethnal Green Road with a, I'd say like 12-inch knife in his trousers.
Yeah.
And the woman just paused and went, yeah, that's definitely an emergency.
Where is
it? I told them where it was.
I told you, in his trousers.
And the kid, we lock eyes.
Right.
And I was like, oh, fuck's sake, shit. And so I basically ran across the road and hid in the pub.
Wow.
And just watched from the window. And sure enough, like a few minutes later, the police came. Arrested.
Damn.
And the woman on the phone was like, what do they all look like? And I went, well, there's the one with the knife is white with ginger hair. He's got a friend, Caucasian, brown hair. There's two Asian guys, two black guys. And then I paused and went, I mean, it's kind of nice that the gang's multicultural in a way. That's progress.
Yeah, genuinely. Yeah. It's a good mix.
If they're going to mug me.
Yeah. If you're going to write that into a TV show, that's fair. It feels like that gang was written.
It was a very 2018 gang. Yeah. Which was great.
Equality.
Every cloud.
So how was it finding yourself in Suffolk? It's not the most...
It's not the most dangerous place in the world.
It's not the most dangerous, but it's also not the most thriving and bubbling. And as someone who I've always known as a creative person in every way, in many different areas, how did that creative flame start when you were potentially in an area that didn't have that many... Did you have a lot of people to look around and go, oh,
no,
I want to be like him or like him? Or was it all in magazines and on TV?
It was all TV. It was all music. I didn't really have any friends till I got to sort of high school age.
Yeah.
And then made a couple of really good friends and had two much older friends that, like, because all I was listening to at that point when I was a teenager was, you know, punk rock and hip hop.
Yeah.
And then I had two older friends that were super into jazz and classical music, stuff like that. And they kind of broadened my mind quite a lot.
That's wicked.
Yeah.
That's so valuable to have.
Yeah.
I always credit my years of working in HMV as really helpful for my musical knowledge coming, because in those days in HMV, you had a person who ran the classical section who knew about classical shit. You had a person who ran the jazz section who knew about jazz, so you could, rather than just walk into this 10-foot row of CDs and pick something out, you could talk to someone and go, I like this, and they'd be able to go, oh, you know that Beastie Boys sample, that's this guy, that might be a good place to start.
I remember,
and things like that were hugely advantageous,
like, I've got a Tom Waits tattoo, and I remember walking into HMV in Norwich and just saying to the guy, oh, someone told me to listen to Tom Waits, what do I do?
I love it.
And this guy went, well, Real Gone is the new album. I'd recommend that. It's great. But I'd start... there's three albums he did. There were Swordfish Trombones, Frank's Wild Years, and Rain Dogs. I'd start with those three. Start with Swordfish Trombones. If you like it, work your way forwards.
Yeah. And that's what HMV was like in my day.
I don't know his name.
Whereas it was the dudes who were just into shit. We'd have that all the time. The HMV in Lakeside, for a long while, I guarantee had the best stock in the country of... alternative hip-hop from Minneapolis, from Rhode Island, from New York, all that kind of... Because, again, I was able to order that stuff and go, let's get all the Def Jux stuff, all the Rhymesayers stuff, all the Strange Famous stuff.
It was in a weird day when HMV went into administration, because I grew up in going to a record store called Sound Clash in Norwich, which is where I used to buy all my hip-hop and all of my punk rock. And then when HMV went into administration... And everyone was like, you need to rally around the independent. I was like, they're not an independent store. They were like the giant enemy when I was a kid.
Yeah.
No offense.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. They weren't an indie store. But when you started to then see the leader of CD sales becoming Asda or Tesco's, then you started to go, oh, HMV, all right. Or even, I mean, we had a rivalry with a Virgin. So my, like, in the time I was working there, so my... view is probably slightly warped, but my view was always that in Virgin, you kind of just had dudes who were there stocking shelves. Yeah. And in HMV, you had dudes who were ordering the CDs and knew the stuff, had the back catalogue and could give you some advice. And it was that weird thing. It had the feel of the biggest indie around. But again, you're completely right. I was the same for a long time. I had the indie record stores I liked supporting, and then it was weird that when HMV was starting to go down, everyone's like, no, save it.
You know what, man? It's a faith I've found, or like a something I've really found with comic books.
Yes.
Is that walking into like my favourite place in London now is, I think, Orbital Comics.
Yeah.
I've only been in there, you know, 5 or 6 times. Yeah. But like actually walking into a room where I have no idea what's good.
Yeah.
Or having like, and then, you know, through the process of a couple of, you know, a year or so of buying comic books now, and having that anticipation, like, yeah, they're released monthly.
Yeah.
Like, it's like your favorite band puts out a record every month. Yeah. And you get to go to the place. And like, I have the same excitement that, and there's a, you know, there's obviously a massive stigma that comes with enjoying comic books. And I don't care. I love it. I text you when I first started thinking about it and getting into comic books, and you recommended a couple of things to me.
Yeah.
And now it's like, it's take. I love that feeling of walking into those rooms. And
for me is exciting because of being kind of reasonably heavily into comics for about 10 years now. Orbit is one in particular that when I go in, I'm trying to clock the reaction of the guy at the counter as I put down my selections to kind of go like, eh? Eh? Like, I know the good shit, right? I'm not just getting the new.
I'm still in that phase where
they never give any reaction at all. But I'm like,
I put mine down, and she's like, I'm buying like the Ed Sheeran and the Coldplay parachutes of comic books at the minute. Oh, Judge Dredd, Volume 1, Issue 1. Wow, Josh,
look at you.
And it's it's that same feeling of record stores though when I was a kid, and it's nice to have something like that as you, because you know, it's not the same going on Spotify.
Yeah,
it's not. I just took all the Kenneth's music off of Spotify because I didn't.
Oh, really?
I just don't like this. I went to one of their talks recently.
I've got a note here, just quickly.
Do not talk about Spotify. No. Are they a sponsor?
Spotify.
Let's shit on them
a bit, because you touched upon it briefly on Stu's one and moved on because you didn't want to be negative. But it is a weird one. I've got all of the speech development stuff on Spotify, but begrudgingly, because that's where people listen to music. And it's a weird one because it has to be clear. I'm not against the people who use Spotify. I understand that. I do find it a little lazy because you'll have music outside of it and they won't go. Like, now people ask, is the podcast going to be on Spotify? And I'm like, it's literally 2 clicks to get
it's
to
on
the podcast.
Every iPhone has a purple podcast. Yeah, yeah,
it's there. And I've got a tweet I never sent in my saved tweets. I was looking literally yesterday. It just says, look, I used to have to go to my CD player, eject the CD, go over to my CDs, take out the one I want, put that in and press play to get a change in music.
Yeah.
And you guys are annoyed with 2 clicks to get a change in music. Like, I don't want to go out of the...
And I'm not glamorizing my childhood at all, because there is a magic to going, oh my God, there's this Ted Heath recording from 1920 with this big band.
Yeah.
Like, I found this song recently by the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, who's a 1920s composer, and the song is called If the Man in the Moon Was a Coon.
Wow.
And it's the most racist. Someone was talking about a racist lyric in a song, and I was like, well, actually, listen to this.
Check this out.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea is, if the man in the moon were black, you wouldn't ever get the moonlight. It's the most racist concept for a song ever.
Hugely offensive, yeah. And,
I found it on Spotify in 8 seconds. So there is a magic to the
completely,
fact that...
Completely. I love the accessibility. I love that it's all there. So it's not the people. It's the issue that I have is that Spotify is a multi-million or billion-dollar company, and yet artists get paid such a small amount. And for me, I always describe it as, it feels like a legalized theft, or it's a subscription of guilt relief.
Yeah.
It's like, in a way, I'd kind of rather you steal my music than make someone else rich off my music.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, do buy my music, but yeah, go on.
I just find it interesting that the thing that really pisses me off about Spotify, right? I went to one of their talks in their building in Soho, right? And the guy walks out with his, like, fucking Steve Jobs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's just walked on the moon.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, music plays, and he's like, hey, guys, help yourself to muffins and coffees and Twizzlers. And anyone want anything to eat? We're going to get lunch soon. All right, guys, let's get... And he's on a stage as well. It's just a talk in their office. Yeah, and the guy's on a fucking stage.
Get off your stage, mate.
Like they are the rock stars.
Right.
And he does this... He talks about an artist who's doing fantastically well. And he says, you know, the way this artist broke is that he uploaded one song every month onto Spotify. And he submitted each song for playlist. Every song was great, so they made the playlist. Now he's averaging 3 million plays a month, and he's selling out, you know, like these big venues in America. Mm. It's all because he was uploading one song a month to the playlist. And there's all these musicians who are like, you know, I'm not very far ahead in the scope of what a career in the music business is, but these people are 15 steps behind me. These are like open mic, acoustic guitar playing people who are doing, you know, who are coming up to London doing gigs in pubs, and they're at the very beginning of their career. And I know for a fact, because I know the artist that he's talking about, I know his management, and Spotify are paying for this guy. They're paying for his billboards. They're trying to break the artist by putting money into his career.
And trying
to basically usurp the record label, which is a legitimate experiment to do, right? Yeah. But to then sell it to kids, like if they submit
to
Spotify,
to this,
it will make their career, is a bold-faced fucking lie.
Completely.
And that is the huge criminal thing I find about Spotify, is that they're lying to up-and-coming musicians. Yeah. Because the reality is I think it's 16...
But you're in control now. It's now all on you.
Yeah.
You don't need a label. You don't need this.
We've democratized it. I think it's 16,000 songs a day get uploaded to Spotify.
Yeah.
Their editorial playlists have, let's say, 500 songs a week. It's just not going to happen. And there's just as much nepotism from record labels chumming. Like, when I walked through the office, I saw about 4 A&Rs that I know from major labels. Yeah. Just there kissing everyone's asses.
Yeah.
And like I don't care that the record labels need to chum up to Spotify. I understand that. Mm-hmm. It's part of the game, right?
Yep,
it's not
completely.
A nice part. But to be lying...
It was the same with a radio's
absolutely.
5 years ago. There were people who were in with the producers of each show.
Yep.
And you know, that's fine. That's doing your job. That gives the worth. So, yeah.
But to be lying to up-and-coming musicians, I found that...
So here's how simple it is. And I would say 1,000 plays would not pay for that fucking muffin that he's offering.
Who was it?
That's a genuinely fucked up thing that you're sat there saying, like, oh, here's all this free stuff. It's like, how about you keep all of the fucking the catering and just give us a bit more money for our music that is earning you guys millions and has made you one of the biggest companies in the world.
I was chatting to
I don't want your fucking free muffins, you prick. But yeah,
I don't know, man, if it's like a blueberry muffin.
I mean, I like muffins as much as the next man, but I'd rather be paying for it off of a good royalty check.
I was chatting to an A&R recently, and he was, you know, he said, you know, we figured it out. Actually, there's just as much money now in the music industry as there was in the 90s. Record labels are making just as much money.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, because you're not paying any of the bands.
Yeah, yeah.
It, you know, there's always going to be the upper echelons of bands that will, you know, be able to buy mansions.
Yeah.
But there just used to be a lot more people that used to be able to buy a flat.
Yeah. Completely.
And now, like, the only musician I know that owns a house had to sell like 3 million albums to do it, to be able to buy a property.
Yeah.
And like, I do think that, and in a way, that's sort of why, it's not really why I stopped doing the Kenneths, but it was definitely a contributing reason, was like, I don't want to be 35 years old in a pub in Brighton, getting paid 70 quid for a gig and selling my merch.
Same attempt, you know, and hustle. Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to move on to that, but just one last thing on Spotify, because I have people ask all the time. The reason I don't put the podcast on there is the only way I can put the podcast on Spotify is removing the adverts and the sponsors. Yeah. And the adverts and the sponsors are the people who've kept this free for 4 years. Yeah. And the people who mean I can pay Buddy Peace, who produces this, and John, who does the social media, and Acast have given me a platform for this 4 years. That's how they get paid. So it's out of loyalty to them that I'm not willing to go on there. Because they'll earn a bit if it's on there. You'd get your fucking your percentage or whatever it is. But it's like, that's why it's not on there. Because I'd rather everyone who's worked hard to make this free for all the listeners who enjoy it every week, I'd rather they get paid than it's suddenly a tiny bit more convenient than one more click to go...
Yeah, but thank you for the muffins.
It's mad,
the muffin basket. I mean, you could pay them a little bit more.
Well, I send them muffins every week. Before we get on to the Kenniffs, when I met you, you were kind of, a singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. You would get mistaken for Richard Iwadi a lot. But because you had that style, you had kind of your bow ties and stuff, and it was all kind of acoustic-y. It was tweedy, it was... equal parts rock and roll as pop and kind of a good mixture of those things. So how did you find yourself in that place musically? How did you feel that was where you needed to be?
You know what? The beginning of me being a solo artist and the Kennetts are exactly the same, which is they were totally unselfconscious.
Yeah.
And there was just a bit in the middle where everything got a little bit fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved to London when I was 18. And just did every gig that I could do.
Yeah.
I did every thing. And, you know, it's one of the things I'm so, so grateful for now. In the light of the YouTube generation of people who were signing deals off the back of having so much exposure and then having to learn stagecraft.
100%,
I'm so, so grateful that, like, I'm not the best singer in the world. I'm not the best songwriter in the world. I'm a fucking good performer.
Yeah.
And I know how to hold a crowd. And that's not arrogant. I've just done 1,000 gigs.
And it's true. I can back that up. And I was talking to Polar Bear about this last night. I was saying the weird thing about if I ever do music again is that one of the things that puts me off playing live gigs again is I've not played for 4 years now.
Mm.
So it'd take a long time to get good again. And the fact is, we all had our years of being shit when there was 4 people in the room.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like we had years and years.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, it does still. If you're proud of where you got to as a performer, it's part of that comes from doing it a week in and week out and getting really good. So a big gap. It wouldn't take as long, but still, there would be some work to be done to get to the level that I left it at.
But it wouldn't be like you're not walking out of the house barefoot. You're just walking out with your shoelaces untied.
I get you.
It's all still there. You just need to refigure out.
But it is
how to get it back. Which wouldn't. You're right. But it wouldn't take long.
But it is an advantage, I think. And it's something I said that these are YouTube blow up kids. Or again, there's numerous different places that people have blown up over the years that they don't get is they're learning that stagecraft when they've already got a big.
Yeah.
Crowd there, and that can go really badly. That can demoralize you. That can put people off you.
You also shouldn't be judged as well. You shouldn't be judged for your first 100 gigs.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and again, although
it's hard work, there is an advantage of doing those 100 gigs to small crowds because it's like no one gets to see you stumble and fall.
Yeah.
By the time a large amount of people are seeing you, you're fucking good.
And also, you make the best friend. Like, how do we know each other?
Yeah.
All the bands who I know now, musicians and comedians and artists who I know and love, who've become, like, very important to me in my adult life.
Yeah.
I met them when we were kids.
Yeah.
With acne in pubs.
And it's like, fascinating because what you've said there has given me the first time I've realised how we all met as such. Because I've always said I loved it that... it was people of all different genres. It was all sorts of things, but we all just worked on these nights. That we worked on these nights. It was that we were all doing 5 or 6 gigs a week.
Exactly.
We were out there doing any night. We weren't going. And I've had mates who are in bands who I love dearly, who I've heard turn down gigs because like, I looked at the headliner and they're not really our kind of thing and all that kind of thing. And I get that, but it's like, I never had any of that. I didn't look at it. I was like, right, am I allowed to play?
Yeah.
I'll be there from doors, and you tell me when to go. And, and that was it. And that's what linked me, you, Paloma, Kate Nash, Adele, Jack Peñate, Stuart James, Peggy Sue and the Pirates. All of these people were just night after night.
Yeah.
Oh, we're on another bill together. That's because there was a pub in London that wanted people to play. So we're going to be there.
Yeah.
It's kind of as simple as that.
It was... I mean, I moved to London, yeah, I was 18, I had an acoustic guitar. I remember when I moved house, I had one box of stuff, moved to Woolwich. I remember I cried the night I moved out.
Amazing.
Right, sat in my on the sofa bed in the flat and cried. Right.
I've been there on them things.
And then just did every show I could possibly do.
Yeah.
And whether it was 30 quid, and some of it was like, I did a gig in a pub. One of the Maccabees was there.
Yeah.
2 months later, I went on tour with the Maccabees.
Yeah.
And that's how that stuff worked. Whenever I see, you know, we toured with Born Ruffians in July.
Yeah.
And someone came up to me and was like, how'd you do it? And I was like, well, I ran a club night when I was 18 and they had a song on the radio and I booked them to come when they were in England.
Yeah.
And now we're friends.
That's genuinely how it works. And and you'll have people and I have people all the time hit me up saying, asking for advice. Like, how do I break? How do I do it? It's like... Stop asking is the first question. It's one of the things that when I had Kate Nash on, that she was saying as well. It's like, just go out there and start doing it. And then you'll meet other people and you'll all be driven by each other. You'll be motivated by each other. And that's how you do it. You get out there and just do anything you can to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's an odd one. You know, I was never part of any scene. I never fit into any of those cliques. I was a little bit too much of this to be that and a little bit too much of that to be this. And I signed a deal when I was 21 with Universal in France. Yeah. So I signed this big, I think it was the biggest, the greatest, really the best deal. I had one gig in Paris. I went over and played in Paris at Le Baron.
Yep.
Did you ever play there?
No, I've been there, but yeah.
Never... And then off the back of that, got booked to play at the Cannes Film Festival.
Wow.
2010, 2009, somewhere like that. And then did Terry Richardson's party.
Wow.
After party at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
Before.
How was that? Did he do anything when absolutely just... appalling? Did he do anything absolutely unforgivable?
I did not see him there.
Right.
And I had this very weird night.
Fuck that guy, just quickly. Fuck that guy. Go on, continue. The beauty of podcasts.
By the way, I wasn't supporting him by doing it. It wasn't out yet.
Yeah.
He was just a photographer who was doing the bad stuff. Yeah. People weren't talking about it at that point.
We didn't know about it at that point.
And I had this very weird night there. It was a very weird week in Cannes. And it's the most debauched place on earth. I'm sure it's not anymore. And, you know, it definitely is. And, and then... because of that, some singer-songwriter who was playing the Cannes Film Festival saw me. He took his lawyer to my next Paris show. And this was Daft Punk's lawyer.
Wow.
So then this guy called Michel came to my Paris gig and bought every label and publisher in France to my gig.
Damn.
So then just record deals in France just were falling out of their asshole to sign me.
It's amazing how that stuff can work in different countries at the right time.
And then my manager sort of arrogantly went, well, you know, if France is offering, then let's wait for England.
Right,
That was probably the first fuck-up.
Yeah.
So we signed a publishing deal in France, and then I made this album with a big French producer, got kind of screwed over by him, then the A&R left, then my manager moved to New York, and it just kind of all fell apart.
Yeah.
And... all the momentum that I'd kind of built up, sort of, you don't see it when it's happening.
No.
And then I went and worked in a toy shop for 4 years.
Wow.
And signed to a very big management company, big pop management company. And they were very much like, they saw what I was doing.
Mm.
And all I'd done was tour as well.
How are those extended periods of promise? Because that's kind of what you live off in the industry at that point. When there's a manager or a company or someone who are saying, you're about to be this guy.
Yeah.
Yet, until then, you're working in a toy shop or you're doing this or you're doing whatever else. But it's such a common thing in the industry. And particularly if people around you, people are being blowing up like Paloma or whoever else. Mm. There is that thing that...
I don't know, I feel it can make you take your eye off why you started doing this and what you
absolutely.
Love about this.
Yeah,
it can make you always be, oh, over there is yeah. this rainbow. And you're kind of ignoring the fact that you're doing 100 gigs.
Exactly.
In the first half of the year or whatever, and that's amazing and exciting. But at that point, all of them are a stepping stone. Yeah. And you don't realise that you're already where, when you were a kid, that's where you wanted to be. You're getting to do this and people are adoring it. But you've got that golden... a ticket being waved at the back of the room. You're like, oh, I'll be there in a minute.
I think for me, like, when I signed that publishing deal in France, we made the decision not to sign a record deal there.
Mm.
And I agreed with that just as much as he did.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when that all fell apart, basically we spent the publishing advance. So for people who are listening, don't know the difference between a record deal and a publishing deal.
Yeah.
A record deal is the ownership of your recording. So let's say you record a song, you put it out. The recording is the record deal.
Yeah.
The publishing, what that means is the publishing of a book.
Yeah.
And in the olden days, songs were written into books. So publishing is the slightly more ethereal concept of owning a song.
Yeah.
So let's say Universal own all of Adele's songs.
Yeah.
Sony can own all of her recordings.
Yeah.
Right? And so
the ones who own the recordings will be getting stuff from record sale, but the ones who own the songs will be getting a bit from the record sale because there'll be a mechanical in there, but they'll also be getting the payment from airplay from any sync deals in films, which again, it all kind of, if it's done right, it all feeds itself. Mm-hmm. If you get a big a sync deal, the label should be thinking, well, we need to make sure that we're promoting the record so we get sales off the back of that sync deal and so on and so forth.
Exactly, I mean, it's the famous Paul McCartney, Michael Jackson story where they were shooting the video for, what's that song? Mine, the girl is mine, that one.
Yeah, the girl is mine.
There we go. Clues in the title, Josh. Yeah. And Paul was like, hey, Michael, you know, you should get into like owning songs, publishing deals.
Yeah.
And then Michael was like, hey, thanks, Paul. And then the next day bought all the Beatles back catalog.
Yeah.
Because it was up for, or the
Insanity,
next, you know.
Right?
But as soon as it was available.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I had a big publishing deal and I didn't realize that traditionally what you're meant to do is you take your publishing deal and you live on it.
Yeah.
And my manager was like, let's get the biggest producer in France who produced all of these big, I mean, my fucking heroes, these artists that I loved. And we'll pay him your publishing deal money.
Yeah.
And the guy who signed my publishing managed this big producer. So he was like, I can get you this big producer.
Yeah.
But then when we were paying the record producer and his manager, that was the money that the manager had given me. So we were paying them back.
Right.
The money. Yeah.
It's a little...
It was like a little racket.
Money laundering.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because, again, a little insight thing there. An advance you get off a record label, that is what should go towards recording
your album.
A record. And an advance you get off of publishing, in theory, should be what goes towards you having the time to record an album, not having to work, not having to be in a 9-to-5 to kind of go, right, here's what I do, here's what I'm living off, and then here's the money to spend on that. They obviously, that was at a time that the record industry was changing a lot.
Absolutely.
And there was a lot of publishing deals going on that were the bigger than record label deals because the record industry was going... Oh shit! People are going to stop paying for music, so we can't invest as much. So, as much as it might feel like the wrong choice now, it was a very common choice at that point to go, well, let's sort our publishing, and then a lot of bands would do self releases, and it'd be sneaky because it's really you're releasing on Sony. It's just that they're your publisher, and they've given you an imprint and helped you, and you're going, oh, I'm just doing it all DIY, but you got given $100,000 or whatever, and
and we did. So we made this record in France, and then the mixes were terrible, and we went back to the producer and the manager. We're like, hey, these mixes suck. Can we have the finished mixes? And they went, mixes? That wasn't in the contract. And it just got overlooked.
Wow.
So then it was like another $8,000 of the advance to get these songs mixed. And by which point, the A&R that signed me left, and my manager, everyone just dropped their tools and was like, fuck it. And like everyone just walked out of the shed. Yeah. And at that point, I was like, well, fuck, what do I do now? And then I got this offer from a very big pop management company who kind of wanted to turn me into I was talking about our Shoes podcast. They were like, he's brown, he's got curly hair. Let's turn him into Bruno Mars.
Yeah. And, amazing, right?
You know, obviously Bruno Mars is phenomenally talented. Aside from being small and brown, I don't think we have anything else in common.
I don't know, but yeah, I get you.
And then they pulled me out of my, again, like, I'm not pointing fingers at them. It's not like, you hear so many people going, I got screwed by my label.
Yeah.
And it's not the truth. The truth is I wanted it just as much as they did.
Yeah.
They were like, hey.
And we made some choices.
If you rejig this, you can be huge. And at this point, I was broke.
Yeah.
And was like, yeah, I'd like any money. Any money would be good.
Would be cracking.
So
And again, it's that illusion that they don't, well, the moves that they suggested for you to make, they wanted them to pay off and work.
Yeah.
They're not some evil. They're not like, oh, we hate Josh. Let's sign him and ruin his career and waste loads of money. Their hope was for it all to turn into a Bruno Mars type thing and all that.
I mean, those days, you know, I mean, the record labels used to do that in the 90s. They used to sign five bands that all sounded the same. There's that story.
To stop four and promote one, right?
The Irish, the Three Sisters and the brother.
The Cause. Yeah.
When Parlophone or whoever it was signed The Cause, who were a Irish pop folk crossover band that did like trad Irish songs but with pop choruses, they signed all the other bands doing it and just shelved them all so that The Cause could like run to the finish line while the record label was holding everyone else back.
It's like Liverpool in the 90s. Liverpool in the 90s were known for signing players to stop other teams having them at points, to go, right, we've got our first team. And again, it's not always that. There's also, they might turn out to be good, but often it was like, right, we don't want him playing our rival, so let's snap him up while he's young, and they end up on the bench and nothing comes around. It's the same outlook, right?
It's the same. I like, and people can judge me for this, but I love Formula One.
Right.
I just love millionaires racing cars.
You do.
Kids of oil tycoons decide that they want to race in a car, and
it's all good fun.
And
all
their
good
dads
clean fun.
Buy them a place in that's what's going on in Formula One at the minute. Like the drivers next year are all 18 years old because every team has gone shit. We can't have them racing for the big teams in 2 years.
Yeah,
let's sign them now to our little team. Yeah,
yeah. It's mad.
Fuck, how was that relate? How did that relate to publishing?
But they were trying to turn you into a Bruno Mars. Their plan was for you to be.
And it just obviously wasn't going to happen. And I spent loads of time in Sweden writing with all these huge pop writers.
Yeah.
And like did like all the co-writes. And they were some of the most soul-destroying. I find co-writing a very weird thing.
I've never done it. It fascinates me. I would like to at some point. Early on, I was asked to write some stuff for The Prodigy.
Mm.
And I wrote some stuff. And I was too ignorant at that point. All I could write was Scroobius Pip stuff. So I sent them a load of Scroobius Pip type
stuff.
Was this?
And
it's like as if Keith Flint is going to do a Scroobius Pip type verse on a Prodigy track. It was around 2007 or 2008. So it was just as we'd blown up and got a bit of hype.
Mm.
And again, now I'm like, I could definitely. I love the idea of those kind of things. But I never have. But what was it? Is it writing?
You know, I cried though when The Prodigy was number one when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, no, I did.
Firestarter came on Top of the Pops, and I cried tears of fear.
It's terrifying.
I cried because I was so scared of the video and for the state of the music industry as well.
Brilliant. I love it. That is a powerful single right there. It's making people cry in their living rooms.
Oh, boy.
So were you writing?
For me.
With people for you.
For me,
That's what sounds...
And some of it was great. Like, I don't think any of the songs were good.
Right.
I wrote a lot with my friend Simon, and we wrote our best songs, and that's what got me the deal in France. And then I did, like, Guy Chambers. And all of these, like, guys in Sweden that now have had, like, Swedish House. I wrote with fucking Swedish House Mafia guys.
Wow. God,
and the thing is, I know, right? And I listened back to all my songs one Christmas... And it was like, you know, because you take on, no one says it when you do a co-write. But the reason people co-write is because they want a chart hit. That's essentially, if you boil down what every co-writing session is, it's because people go, well, he can write a chorus. You know, I guarantee you, if you look to the top 40 right now, I would say 90% of it is co-writes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Completely.
And that's fine. It has its place in the industry. It has its place as a business. And I'm not judging it. but it wasn't for me. And you take on the identity of everyone you write with. And naturally, you know, you're two sponges smooshing against each other. So
yeah.
The water's going to be from a little bit of each sponge.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And I listened back to all my songs one Christmas and was like, you know, one song sounds a bit like The Cure, one sounds like Swedish House Mafia, one sounds like Ray Charles, one sounds like, mm-hmm. you know, it was a Guy Chambers co-write, and it just had no fucking identity.
Right.
And it was all so desperate.
Yeah.
It was all so like, just please give like me a record
this.
Deal.
Yeah, please connect to this.
And like, you can smell that shit a mile off. And yeah. like, I fucking hated all of it.
Yeah.
So I quit and just was like, I'm done being a solo artist.
Yeah.
And that's when the Kenniffs.
It's a big move, right?
Yeah.
And it was exciting when I saw the Kenniffs, because having met you and booked you at one gig.
Where was that? It was in a record store.
Pure Groove.
In Farringdon.
Farringdon. And that's where the picture of us outside is from 10 or so years ago. And you had your hair going up and I had my beard going down and we were just the opposite.
One of us should tweet it when it comes out because we look like opposite. It's like Guess Who.
Completely.
It's like if you flip a painting of someone upside down and it's the same, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We
yeah,
look
exactly.
like complete opposite twins of each other.
I love it. But I'd booked you for one of those shows and knew you as this singer-songwriter in Tweed. And then when we'd talk outside of it, we'd be talking about Glassjaw and we'd be talking about Rancid and we'd be talking about a look at our record stuff and Weezer and all sorts of stuff, and I was like, all right, that's not what I got from you up there. And again, not that wasn't the real you, everyone's got a lot of sides to them and facets, but when the Kenniffs came about, again, it was another one that you went from this really distinctive kind of nerd chic looking kid to the most rock and roll looking dude ever.
Yeah.
Yet, as I was saying before, it didn't seem jarring, it didn't seem fake, it didn't seem false. It seemed to go, here we go.
It was like a transition that took like 4 years as well. But it obviously, there was a gap of me doing kids' parties and blowing up 200 balloons every Saturday morning. And one of my mates, who's a musician, was going on tour. We lived together. And his band was doing really, really well. And he said, he was like, okay, he's like, let's set you a challenge. If you hate all your music and no one's listening to it, you might as well make what you want to make. Because then if no one listens to it, you're still making the music that you like.
100%.
It's such an obvious thing to say to someone, but it all
such
gotten
great
so lost.
Advice, though, yeah.
Yeah. It all gotten so lost in this chasing a deal or
a chart position, all of that.
Yeah, and so I just sat down and wrote what was honest, and what was honest was just these 2.5 minute punk songs.
Yeah.
And then the Kenniffs had a really fucking clean run for like 3 years. Where couldn't really do anything wrong. And
it's amazing to watch because
the thing that put us on the map was that we got the Warp Tour like after like 12 weeks of
and
being
that was
a band.
I was on your case immediately, like, you fucking prick.
Because
I think that was just as I'd stopped making music, and that was the one place I'd always wanted to play.
I emailed Kevin Lyman for you, right?
Yeah. I hit you up and we were, he showed a bit of an interest. I was like, I've kind of stopped performing,
and then he
but at that point,
tour,
I was like,
he?
I might come back if it was the Warped Tour, because, again, I remember reading about Sage Francis on the Warped Tour and POS on the Warped Tour and the rap acts that won over the punk crowds that went out starting to get
Eminem.
Booze and piss thrown at them and then won them over and became the hits of the tour. I was like, I want that. I grew up as a punk kid, but then I became a rap kid. It's like, I know. Like, it was always Warped Tour and Download that I really wanted to play because they were both
You've particularly done Download
when,
now.
No, I never
really?
Have. Particularly when I had my solo band. And at Reading and Leeds, we had the biggest circle pit I've ever seen in my life. Previously, it had been a Rancid gig.
I mean, I saw Obama's circle pit and it was much bigger.
But that's it. I was like, I was convinced I could, with the band I had on that solo tour and how rowdy we got, I broke my ribs 3 times on that tour just from getting too rowdy. And I was like, I'm convinced I can go to Download and have them all hating me at the start and loving it by the end because we'll go as hard as anyone and all that. But it never happened. But you guys, in your first year, right, you got to go and do...
First 2 years of Download,
Or no,
twice.
Warped, sorry.
Warped. Warped was one of those weird ones where...
It seemed like you just started and it's like, I've got a new band. Oh, and also...
It was pretty much...
We're going on water.
It was a weird one. We did a music video before anything.
Yeah.
sensible. And
completely.
I asked Leanna Havas to be in the video.
Wow.
So she played me in the video.
Amazing.
So then we put that out, and the song was a minute long, minute and a half long. And God bless her for doing it, because all her fans were like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. But she's amazing, man. Have you had her on here? She's dope. I haven't. I've never even met her. But she's dope because she's got her thing. She's had amazing success. She's knocked about with Prince. That just blows my mind from top to bottom. But the fact is, she does her own thing. She will go, yeah, I'll come and do this video because I want to. Yeah. It won't be, I'll just check with these people or that people. It's like,
she got us to open for her at the Royal Albert Hall, amazing. Which was one of the greatest gigs of my life, and just such a huge mistake for her.
Yeah, like, completely. She wanted it to be a band that she liked.
Yeah. She wanted it to be a band that she loved, and a friend, and her label were throwing all these like diet Leanne's at her to open.
Yeah.
And so she called me and was like, hey, I'm doing the Albert Hall in two months. I went, yeah, can I come? She went, yeah, do you want to open? And I thought she was kidding for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, all right.
And I emailed our booking agent and I emailed our manager and went, hey, we've just got an offer from Leanne to do the Royal Albert Hall. I'm going to CC you in with her so she can put you in touch with her agent so you guys can talk about it. Our agent and manager email back. They've taken Leanne out of the loop and they say, don't do the gig. Because she's a soul singer, you're a punk band. This is the dumbest idea ever.
Yeah.
And I thought about it and was like, well, The Clash took all those reggae bands on tour.
100%.
It's not quite the same. And also, when I'm an old man, do I want to remember having played the Royal Albert Hall?
Yeah.
Or do I want to remember turning it down because of my laurels?
Yeah, no, like, completely.
And so we did it, and...
Again, it's the attitude that we were talking about of when you were an open micer or whatever, you're doing any gig that you can get. If anyone had asked you to do the Royal Albert Hall, you'd be like, yes, of course.
Jim Davidson.
Yeah. That's it. Unless there's someone morally you're against. But still, you might take that as an opportunity to do a bit of an MIA at the Super Bowl and stick a finger up and stuff like that.
Get a nipple out.
Yeah, exactly.
And from the 1,000 gigs, however many hundreds and hundreds of gigs that came before it, it wasn't a nerve-wracking experience. Yeah. It was like, I'm going to walk onto that stage and just enjoy this feeling of fucking Frank Sinatra stood on this spot.
Yeah.
And now this fucking idiot with his dumb songs about erections gets to do the same thing. Like, that's insane. And like, who... And that, you know... That's a whole other argument about the genres. There's no cross-pollination in the way people play music together.
And it's more exciting to take those risks a little bit. As I said, having a light version of what you're coming to see, I'll skip that.
But you know what?
Have something completely different. That might catch your eye.
Exactly. And we got so much shit from it. I mean, they're some of my favourite tweets. I looked them up recently.
Brilliant.
And it's some of my favourite insults ever.
Yeah.
And like, some woman was like, my daughter's crying at Leanne Havas, who is this opening band?
Brilliant.
Yeah. And
that has to go on a poster at some point.
And she knew it was going to be a disaster, but it doesn't matter because it was an honest evening.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so Warped Tour was 3 years before Warped Tour, I did Hard Rock Calling.
Mm-hmm.
And got hammered with some guy from Hard Rock afterwards. Turns out he's now one of my close friends. And when the Kennets started, he went, hey, send me a demo.
Yeah.
And I sent him my demo, and they had a stage at Warped Tour, and he sent it to Kevin Lyman, and Kevin Lyman booked us.
Wow.
And Kevin Lyman looked up after us to the point where we got paid, like, so Warped Tour was 52 shows.
Madness.
In 42 days or something. Yeah, man.
Mate.
Yeah. In that heat and that, basically... It's either desert dry heat or humid. It's like
and festival as well. Yeah. I mean, I've done some tours where it's a lot of shows, but it's your gigs. So even though it's rough and killer, it's your gigs. This is, here you are, turn up and play, and people might hate it.
And we did. He put us on a production bus, so we didn't have to worry about getting ourselves across the country.
Yeah.
And he gave us like something like £750 a show. So that paid for like flights, visas, and then we made a load of like the one thing that we managed to do on that tour was we won everyone over as like the DIY British punk band.
Yeah.
Purely by accident.
Right.
Because they went, you know, we were going to America, so we thought, shit, we better get some merch made. So we made one t-shirt one CD.
Yeah.
And then the thing with Warped Tour is every band on Warped Tour has two or three crew with them.
Yeah.
They have the TM, they have the merch guy. And then, you know, a day on the Warped Tour is this, right? You wake up at 6:30 in the morning. You get off your bus or out off your van or your sleep or whatever it is. And then you try and find the stage because the stages are all traveling stages. So sometimes the stage is 100 feet from your bus. Sometimes it's a mile away.
Yeah.
Around the back of the bus is the trailer. You pull all your merch out of the trailer.
Yeah.
Which at this point, when we got there, we didn't have a trolley or anything.
Yeah.
So we had to buy all the stuff in a Walmart.
Brilliant.
And then they have drop-off points on the tour, so every 10 shows, you go to pick up your merch. Which sounds easy, but when it's 3 miles away and it's 42 degrees, it becomes a fucking ordeal.
Yeah, 100%.
So we pull the stuff out, we take it to the stage, you have a dogfight with everyone around your stage about, you know, who gets closest to the stage that day.
Right.
You want people to not have to look for your merch stand
afterwards. Yeah, of course.
And then you go get some breakfast, catering, and then you wait for your stage time. You have a different stage time every day.
Wow.
And then when your stage time's announced, you have like 500 flyers that we got made every day of the show. And then you write down your stage time on each flyer. Then you go out into the crowd. You give the flyers out to the thousands of people in the crowd, try and persuade them to come to your gig.
Come see us.
Then you go back to your bus, cool down, get ready to play. If you're on at 3 in the afternoon, you know, you chill out for a bit or you go watch some other bands.
Yeah.
You go get your instruments, walk it all to the stage, warm up, play for 35 minutes, sell merch for 3 or 4 hours, pack it all down. Have a solar shower, which is it's a plastic bag that you put on the bus
amazing.
At the start of the day that would warm up with water, wash yourself down.
Oh, wow.
Get on the bus, do that another 51 times.
That's insane, isn't it?
And so it was like, you know, we definitely earned our stripes on that tour because after a week or so, a month or so, all the bands were like, this band doesn't have anyone doing their stuff.
They're doing it all.
They're doing it all themselves. And they're like, and we were like, we just, you know, we're a punk band. We would lie through our teeth. It was just, no one told us.
We just didn't know you were meant to do
it. No one told us.
Yeah.
And then we had one t-shirt design, which was like, to them, was the most punk rock.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you guys got one t-shirt, man. It's so punk. And we were like, it was totally on purpose.
I love it. So, I mean, there's more I want to talk about in the Kenniffs, and we're over the hour mark, but we'll just keep going as long as
we can. We'll burn through.
One of the things I want to quickly touch upon is when you talked on Hardcore Listening, and one of the songs that came up was I'm the One by the Descendants, and it killed me that Stu and Chris didn't seem to have any knowledge of it, because it's one of those classic kind of inspire you as a kid punk songs. Are you familiar with a Leatherface?
The band.
Not a Day Goes By is my I'm the One kind of thing. It was that thing that it was like, I found it way after it had come out, and then realised it had come out in like 91, and it had influenced a lot of your Lookout type bands, and they're just some band from Leeds. And the only reason I found them was I was on tour in Berlin, and we had a day off, and my tour manager guy was like, oh, I'm going to see this punk band, and he knew I was into punk. I was like, yeah, I'll come along. And I've never heard of Leatherface, and they just blew me away in their like 40s or 50s. And Not a Day Goes By was just one of the most perfect pop punk or skate punk or whatever you want to call it that isn't derogatory songs I've ever heard. So how were those songs for you growing up? Things like The Descendants.
Yeah, finding The Descendants was like,
because you got a Descendants tattoo, and they mean the world to you, right?
It was a pivotal moment in my childhood, was punk rock, I think. And you know, all my friends were listening to really aggressive, politicized, you know, Strike Anywhere and Rise Against and Pennywise, Lagwagon. Not so much Lagwagon. But for me, it was always the melody, and actually, Descendants are really good pop writers as
100%.
Well. Like, they have unbelievable choruses and
just
in their songs.
Connectable in their writing. Whereas, again, I completely agree, there was a point where everything was quite political, or it was very much about a certain part of LA, your Orange County or your whatever else and all this kind of thing. And The Descendants came out. And, I mean, I'm the One's the perfect example, because it's just about that girl who isn't giving you any attention. She's your mate, but she's with these piece of shit guys time after time, and you're there like, what the fuck, what's wrong? Look, I'm right here. and you're going on, you're coming and crying on my shoulder, and you're saying what pieces of shit they are, but I'm literally here, and I am a man, yeah. I'm a boy, what's going on? And that was just, stuff like that was just so relatable, and they were one of the first ones to have that kind of, type sound of vocal that I'd heard, that then it was your Green Days, everyone that came after them, Screeching Weasels at that point.
I mean, you
like
wouldn't,
that.
Without the Descendants, you wouldn't have Green Day, you wouldn't have Blink.
Yeah, yeah.
And so pop punk wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
The Descendants were really, I mean, obviously the Ramones, but the Descendants were the first sort of SoCal punk band that were not politicized.
Yeah.
They were singing about girls and food. And nerd culture,
and SoCal's the key part there, because the Ramones felt so New York and so gritty and so serious, and it was the Descendants who then spawned all. Yeah. Again, I still unashamedly have Green Day as one of the bands that have influenced my life more than anything, and they went in and out of fashion and so on and so forth, but those records at that time meant the world, and it was then looking back and finding the influences that...
Exactly, I mean, you could say the same, the first... four REM albums, first four U2 albums, but, before they broke, they're very different bands to what they are now.
Yeah.
And, Green Day are the same. I think Nimrod's one of my favourite albums ever. Well, the opening track certainly is.
Yeah.
And with the Descendants, I mean, because we did a record with Bill from the Descendants.
Yeah.
He produced Double N.
That's where I wanted to go with this, how the get through a few of the... how the fuck did this happen moments that seemed to all come with the Kenniffs. Yeah. It seemed to be that it was with those guys that I'd see you announce a tour support with a band that I know that both of us grew up listening to. And you've dropped it all casual. Like, we're supporting this band. It's like...
I was freaking out.
You're climbing the walls at
it
that.
Working with
Billy from the Descent, that must have been one of the first kind of...
There's
what?
So much shit where I would... I look to the side of the stage... Summer Before Last, and was like, fucking Brad Wilk from Rage Against the Machine is watching our set. And you're like, this is...
Right.
And then, and Juliet Lewis doing that, and then doing The Offspring, and, all of these things that were, huge for me as a kid. And Descendants was...
Less Than Jake as well, right?
Yeah, that was a big one. Hello Rockview was one of the first albums I ever bought. And we did... on Warped Tour, our then manager had known Bill. She managed Rise Against.
Right.
So Bill had produced three Rise Against albums.
Right.
So she sends our stuff to Bill, and then I wake up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and have an email that says bill@descendants.com. And I was like, what the fuck? And
I mean, you've just given away his email address, but but sure.
Something like that. Shit.
That's mad.
And then
he
flew over to England with Jason, his engineer, and we did five songs together, and that was the third EP.
How quickly did you show him your tattoo?
Last day.
You got to hold off on this shit.
This is a good Bill fact for you. So Bill is obsessed with Cole Porter,
right,
and Irving Berlin,
wow,
and all the Tin Pan Alley, jazz standards, musical songwriters.
Wicked.
And that's a real common thread. Once you know that and you listen to how the Descendants structure their songs,
wicked,
and how much he's about the chorus and the melody, it makes total sense that he loves Kiss Me Kate, And he's this... Bill should not... he's had a brain tumour.
Wow.
A triple bypass, blood clots in his feet that travelled up and blocked his lungs.
Man.
And he's the most punk rock motherfucker you'll ever meet. And he's just the nicest guy that will, part of his brain tumor was that he apparently he can't smell anymore and he doesn't get hangovers.
Wow.
So he just does not stop drinking
when
you go out.
God damn.
And he's still in Black Flag. And, he was in the Lemonheads. And then he came and did our dumb record. And it was...
mind-blowing, right?
Yeah, and then we got to do, we opened for them, and it was, that's something that I can smile at on my deathbed,
So why did it come to the end with the Kenniffs? Because this is quite a new thing.
Yeah, it was 3 weeks ago.
It's 3 weeks, and when this comes out, it'll be a month or two.
Hang on, wait, we'll cut that out. It was 2 months ago?
It seemed to come out, and of nowhere. And it's always that thing of anyone that you're following through social media, you're not following the real world. You're following a blurred version. But from what I'd kind of seen, all I remembered was all these amazing, like, oh, my God, you're playing with these people. You're doing that. So for me, it was going ridiculously well. Again, I've been on the other side of that as well. I've known when the perception is we're the biggest band in the world and the reality is we're touring in a tiny van and we're just trying to make ends meet. So
I think...
So what brought it to an end?
Every record we put out, we set ourselves a different goal. The goal was put out... You know, the first record was, let's do some touring. Second record was, you know, let's try and get to America. Let's try and find a manager. Let's try and find a booking agent. And we did it, and we put the record out, and we got it.
Yeah.
And the third record, you know, we thought, well, let's find a producer that we love. And we got Bill Stevenson.
Yeah.
And fourth record was, you know, let's work with a producer that we love, and let's try and get a record deal. And we got Ben Babtie to produce it, who's one of the best producers in Britain.
Yeah.
And no record deal came.
Right.
And the amount of radio play that the record got, you know, we got a lot of Radio 1, we got a lot of 6 Music, we got playlisted on Radio X, I think playlisted on 6, and it just didn't connect.
Mm.
It didn't get the Spotify playlisting, it didn't get... No matter what we did, whether it was the song was on a Doc Martens album, the song was on Made in Chelsea, the song was on Radio 1, like, none of it was connecting. We weren't getting on the tours that we wanted, no labels were taking a punt on the band.
Yeah.
And then our agent dropped us. He took on some big American rapper and didn't have time. And we were with an agency that got bought out by a bigger company, and they just cut the rosters of the bands.
Right, yeah.
And I could tell he felt terrible about it. And then it's just business. But I'd been through that as a solo artist, where I saw people dropping the tools and being like, yep. Not happening.
Yeah,
and it got harder and harder to get in touch with our manager, and it got harder and harder. No booking agent would take us on, and you know, even the ones that I thought we could walk into wouldn't.
Yeah.
And it just made me look at the project and go, well, what is it? What's fundamentally jarring with this that's making people not want to take a risk?
Okay, yeah.
And having been through it, I kind of figured, well, in 2 years I'm going to be breaking the band up anyway with the trajectory of things are going.
Yeah.
So fuck it. Like, I might as well move on to the next thing now.
Yeah.
And
makes sense.
And I still don't feel sad about it, because all I'll do is, you know, I have enough. I'm very lucky to have fallen into a couple of other really good things. And it's only sad if you quit, I think.
Yeah.
And actually, I'll take the experiences from the Kenneths and I'll put the mistakes and the good bits into the next thing.
Yeah, and it's that beautiful thing. I think there's something so valuable, and it's stuff that I've gone through in recent times, so valuable of choosing to do something.
Yeah.
So I'm going and doing this because this is my choice, not because it's falling apart or it's got to this point where this has happened or that. It's, you've got to the point where you've gone, right, it's going all right. It's not where we want it to be, but I'm going to walk away now because I want to focus on this, rather than I've dragged it out to its last bit.
Do you know what I mean?
It's making that choice so that you know that the things you are doing instead, you're there because you want to be there, not because, oh, I've got to do something.
Yeah,
I've got to fill this gap.
That's exactly what it was. I knew that, and it wasn't connecting in the way that we did the Born Ruffians tour in July, and we did Glasgow, and we played Glasgow 15 times in the last 3 years. And there was no one there to see us. None of the fans came to the show. And when the band made a few categorical errors with the team we put around us. And, you know, we assumed that our audience was a lot younger than it actually was.
Right.
Our demo was 20 to 35 for the people who actually listened to our songs.
Yeah.
And our team were like, you know, oh, your fans are 12 to 18.
Yeah.
So we pushed it as a pop punk thing.
Yeah.
Which it wasn't pop punk. It was punk rock, but it was, melodic. Songwriting. And by the time we were like, oh shit, our fan base is actually a lot older, it was too late, because the older people thought that's for kids.
And
the kids hadn't connected with it.
Right.
So, you know, once you've made that mistake, you can spend a bunch of time trying to fix it, or you can just fucking try a new thing. So, you know,
can walk away from it. Well, I'll start to wrap things up now.
Yeah.
What on this list of things here can we actually talk about of what you're doing next. There's a little, ignore the last one.
Oh,
that's just a real question. So
the statement is, I'm better at this than Stu.
Yeah. that's
I mean, we're not finished yet. Let's see how it wraps up. So I have this is the first.
This is because I know there's a lot of things coming, and I don't know which ones you can announce. I know so this isn't coming out for a few weeks. So
I mean, I don't. The stand-up thing was not something I wanted to go into because I don't want people to think that I want to be a stand-up. There were just a few. I just would hate to be 40 and have not
tried
to hone it. You know. And I want to get good at it.
Yeah.
And it's not a career choice. It's purely for me.
Yeah,
and we've had experiences with the Kenneths where I've walked away from the gig going, what won the audience over there? Was it the songs or was it me chatting shit?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just exploring that avenue.
It's a beautiful one to explore because it is. It's such a fine line. And the only way you can find out is by going out there and doing what you're doing. Because there's been points where, I've seen bands who the reason they're getting laughs is because it's their fans and they're there. And I've seen other bands that I'm like, that would get laughs in any room.
Exactly.
And it's such a, it's impossible for you to know which one that is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Am I getting laughs because they're into me, they're into us, or because it's funny? So
And I'm going to suck at it for a long time, but then I won't suck at it. And then, and that will be a nice place to be at.
Yeah.
But no, I have a comic book coming out.
Yes. And that's what's exciting. That's kind of what we've held off on this podcast a little bit because we wanted to be able to talk about that. And there was
this is the announcement.
Excellent.
This is an exclusive.
Exclusive. I love it.
This I signed a deal with College Humor's Dropout Comics.
Yeah.
So I pitched an idea for a comic book to College Humor.
Yeah.
In November.
Yeah.
Of last year, and they read my pitch and liked it, and I was worried that I wouldn't get the job. I found out that my comic book was up against the two guys who did Rick and Morty. So I was down to the last two of this group.
Good Lord.
So I sent a fake bribe to the boss of College Humor, who I've never met. I sent him $10 and a Dashboard Confessional CD.
Amazing.
I've just finished the
overall value of $8.
The first series of my first comic book, which is called Die Already, which is out October 15th.
Amazing.
Whenever this comes out, that would be the date that the first one is out.
That's exciting, right?
It's really exciting.
You've sent me a little image of of it looks, and
I sent you a text when I got the offer, being like, mate, I've never read a comic book.
Literally go, dude, I've got this comic deal. I don't know how to, I've never asked, can you recommend someone?
You're The Preacher.
I'll leave it with me. Here's where you need to go. But how exciting is that? So what's the kind of, what kind of comic book is it? What is
it's an action based black comedy or dark comedy. Yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky to have had Gabby Epstein illustrating it, and she's so talented and like totally gets my humor, and in a way it's my tribute to the action movies of the 80s as well, the Predators, the Die Hards,
there's a lot
of that in there. There's a lot of in jokes. I wrote the Kenneths into it.
Amazing.
And it's about a guy called Richard Dink, who is a recovering alcoholic who wakes up one day and this consortium of hitmen are trying to kill him.
Amazing.
And it's him, and they're all very real hitmen. One is an Uber driver.
Brilliant.
One is the Kenneths, who only make $11 a month on Spotify, so they have to kill people to make up for the discrepancy in their rent.
Yeah, I love it.
And then there's a guy called The Reviewer, who used to work at, we had to call it the New New Yorker.
Right.
But Prince dead, so he has to kill people. There's someone called the Auntie, who is a woman who her husband's left her. She refuses any alimony from him. She wants to reclaim her independence because she got married in the 70s when reasons for getting married were very different to what they are now. So she's killing people to reclaim her independence.
There's a
hipster chef called Jacqueline Pistolet.
Amazing.
And it's all these very real hitmen, and they're all chasing down Richard Dink. And they are part of a consortium of hitmen in a world where there's different levels of hitmen guilds, basically.
Yeah.
And it's Richard Dink trying to figure out why people are trying to kill him.
I love it. And
it's so hard to not give away the ending. And I had a conversation with my editor yesterday saying, yeah, do I tell them what happens? And she was like, no, what are you...
No, 100% not, you idiot.
If M. Night Shyamalan had been like, yeah, he's dead.
He's dead, by the way. Just a little thing.
It's a village, but it's modern times.
Smell this dead guy. That's exciting. It's hugely exciting because there's been a few attempts in recent years in film to go back to your Die Hard, your Predator type era, and none of them have hit for me, because in film it always feels like it's modern.
Yeah,
it always feels like it's trying that, but comic books have a way of feeling retro in their very nature.
Yeah,
so it kind of, it excites me that I've not really seen anything that goes in that area or in that direction. It excites me, the idea of that, to get your teeth into something that, because I love comic books, but I know that certain areas of graphic novels now have gone amazingly highbrow, and that can be dope, but also it can be daunting at points, because you're like, right, I'm going to have to get through this. This is very clever. And other areas, it's characters who've been around for years and years and years, and this feels like it sits in that middle bit of like, it's going to be fun. It's going to be an enjoyable a ride that we take you on, and that
it's a really, it's a fun read. It's lighthearted and I think hopefully sentimental, and I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud of the, you know, one of my favorite characters is going back to the 80s action films, is a hitman, and Richard Dink's best friend, his name is Blaine McDillan Dutch,
right?
Who's
great
an
name.
Ex-army patriot American guy struggling with alcoholism. They support each other in AA. But Blaine McDillan Dutch, like Blaine, Mac, Dylan, and Dutch are the four main characters in Predator.
Amazing.
So when I was like, what do I call this guy? I was like, I'll just call him everything that those guys are. I'll just give him all of their names.
That's genius. I love things like that where you're going to be able to just hunt for little...
There are so many Easter eggs in this comic book. Yeah. A lot of... There's a few Good Descendants hidden things as well.
Amazing.
In there. Yeah.
I can't wait, man. Well, I'll wrap things up there. Is there anything else that you need to... Like, where can people find you on socials and things? I'm sure that's where you'll be pushing everything from.
It's just Josh. If you just Josh Weller.
Yes.
It, I guess, yeah.
And excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Mate, thank you very much for having me.
For coming along and chatting. It's been an absolute joy. And it's better than really Stu, good. Right? More enjoyable than...
Each case on their merits.
Yeah. Pip. You know, the fact that I didn't have the crutch of a top five or these seven songs from when you were growing up, you know, it kind of puts me above...
You sound self-conscious and you sound defensive and you sound like, yeah.
The fact that I've fallen back on referencing his podcast about 12 times shows how dope his podcasts are, so I can't...
You're
I
both
can't
very talented young men.
Thanks, Mum.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go, that was Josh Weller. I'm going to keep the outro brief, because the intro was long as hell. I love Josh. Do check him out and do follow all of his stuff. And get his comic that's coming out incredibly soon. I can't wait to read it, so that's dope. But there'll be tons on that on Josh's... social media. He texted me the other day because he did his first post that's kind of hinting at the comic or the stuff that's to come, and it's a huge deal for him. He's been working on it for a long time, and the post got like 12 likes, but if he posts a picture of his words were a cat playing with a dildo, it gets a few hundred likes. And it's the wonder of social media, isn't it? A real kind of, look guys, I'm really excited to announce this. I've been working on this for so long and I've had to keep it quiet. And people are like, yeah, whatever. But go and follow Josh and show him the good following of Team 3W, of the Distraction Pieces crew. Let's give you some information on what's to come. Oh man, on next week's one is one of my favourites. It's with Desiree Akhavan. And she has got a new series starting on Channel 4 next week on October 10th. The podcast comes out the day the show starts. It's called The Bisexual and it's brilliant. It's with Maxine Peake, who I adore.
And now I adore Desiree Akhavan. I wasn't really aware of her for some reason until the podcast came about. And I get pitched a lot of people and I turn a lot down. But this one came through and they sent me a link to one of her films and I watched it and I was like, man, that's really good. And they added a link to another one. I watched that. I was like, that's really good as well. And then I watched a couple of episodes of the series I'd preview links. I was like, this woman is brilliant and is amazing. So yeah, it's very exciting. You're going to love it. The week after that, I'm doing you a double because I've got so many recorded and you deserve it, man. You've been waiting for this one for a while because I've teased it, but Dr. Kate Devlin, author of Turned On, which is kind of a history of sex robots or robots, sex toys, AI, all that kind of thing. Really good episode. And that week I'm going to give you a Friday one too, because I sat down and chatted with Gizzy Erskine, who's a great cook and just amazing, interesting. A woman. We got into some stuff that she's not talked about anywhere else. And that was fascinating. And then after that, finally, I'm going to give you the Epic Beardmen one, Sage Francis and B. Dolan. It's tough because things move around a lot. Again, the Patreon lot hear this a lot, but things move around a lot because I'll have a podcast guest come in that's got a specific thing that they want to promote. And as you've heard from the podcast, I said this outro would be short. I lied. As you know from this podcast, even if they're promoting us something, we go all over the place. I don't do these 10-minute, here's an advert. We talk about everything. But if they do have something specific that they want to draw attention to, that I'll plug in the intro or outro, then we go on specific dates. And that just means that the ones that don't have specific time scales, like the Sage and Dolan one, Sage and Dolan finished their tour, and they're now kind of off until the end of, or the beginning of the new year. So there's no rush on that one. It's one of the best conversations I've had. It's two of my genuine closest friends in the world. So, yeah. So that'll be coming out before the end of October. I'm potentially going to be ending October with one of the biggest guests I've ever had. But as ever, I don't want to announce it until I've recorded it. I've been lining it out for years. I've got it scheduled to be recorded as you hear this next week. So if it happens, I might announce it. I'll post it on the Patreon, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. But yeah, it's one of the biggest guests I will have ever had, and it's someone who I don't think has done many podcasts. I've not seen that many interviews with them. So yeah, that's exciting. But yeah, some good ones to come. I'm going to go head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com if you want to spend some of your payday earnings. Other than that, I'll see you next week for free, as ever, as I'm joined by Desiree Akhavan in one of my favourite chats I've had. And yeah, tons more to come. Ta-ta! Oh, and big love to Buddy Peace and Lady H, who recently got engaged, and it was a beautiful thing, and it brought a tear to the eye that is fueled by my cold, dead heart. So, yeah, big love to those two beauties. I'll see you all next week. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.